How's the sound back there? It's okay. Good. It's kind of hard to believe it's the last night. So the topic tonight of the talk is the happiness of Dharma practice, the happiness that comes from the Eightfold Path. And one of the ways that we can think of the Four Noble Truths is suffering and the cause, and happiness and the cause. And happiness is very interwoven in the practice of the Dharma. And I wanted to start with a story that actually came up in one of the practice groups. It's a story about the Dalai Lama and a time when he was traveling in the United States. I think it was in Colorado. And he was having lunch with a group of people, a little entourage that he was traveling with. And I kind of imagine the story that, everybody was sort of on their best polite behavior, and the conversation was tentative, and those kind of group events. And in the midst of this, a waitress came over to the table, and she sat down next to the Dalai Lama, and she said, "Can I ask you a question?" And he said, "Yes, you know." And she said, "What's the meaning of life?" And everybody in the table was kind of like, "Oh, real question." He said, "The meaning of life is happiness." That's an easy question. That's a really easy question. The meaning of life is happiness. The hard question is what makes happiness. What makes a happy life? He said, is it money, a big house, accomplishments, friends? Or he paused, compassion and a good heart. This is a question all human beings must try to answer. What makes true happiness? He gave this last question a peculiar emphasis and then fell silent, gazing at her with a smile. And this is really at the heart of our Dharma practice, what makes true happiness. And strangely, we don't know until we pay attention. This is actually what mindfulness practice is for, is to start to see for ourselves what actually does make for happiness, what actually does make for suffering. And there's so much momentum in the mind, this quality that we've been talking about of craving, of wanting, of getting away from, that we have to actually train the mind to break this habit so that we can look more clearly and perceive actually the happiness that's available to us in our life. So the first dharma happiness, the first causes and conditions that we create through that create happiness is generosity. What we talked about this afternoon, and I loved what Kaura and Winnie said, and it would be hard to add really to that. But here's a quote from the Buddha: "If beings knew, as I know, the results of giving and sharing, they would not eat without having given, nor would the stain of miserliness overcome their minds. Even if it were their last bite, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared if there were someone to receive their gift." And as was said today, the Buddha began the gradual teaching of the Dharma with generosity. This was the first teaching, that movement of the heart to give. And also knowing that when we do give and that generosity is cultivated, it brings happiness. And that happiness is a sign of the happiness of the path. I heard a really great story about this felt sense of happiness. It was on a podcast when I was driving around LA, and it was a story about, it was on The Moth, I think, that radio show, and the overall content was about experiences that changed people's lives. And so the story was, it was told by a man who was Indian and went to school. He was in university in India studying to be an engineer. And his uncle went to America. And when his uncle came back, he said to him, "I have something for you. It's amazing. It's from America. It's a Kit Kat." And he gave it to him, and he looked at it and he thought, it was amazing. You know, it was in this beautiful package and all wrapped up, and he was really excited to get it. And he really wanted to taste it. But there was a custom in at school that whenever you got food, you shared it with your roommate. So he thought, well, if I just had a little bit of my share now, it wouldn't matter. So he opened it up and he tasted it and he said, wow, it really was amazing. And then he couldn't stop himself, and he had a little more and a little more. And then he said, by some twisted logic, he thought, well, there's so little left, I should eat the whole thing. And then he said something really amazing happened. It was like a message from God, and this is why it changed his life, because his roommate came into the room. Of course, he was feeling a little ashamed and uncomfortable, and his roommate came in and his eyes were really bright and happy, and he looked at him in the eyes and he said, "I have something amazing. It's from America. It's a Kit Kat." And he said he'd never, you know, he had never heard or seen a Kit Kat before, and then it happened twice in the same day. And his roommate said, "And I want to share it with you." And he said that they were in engineering school, so he cut it in half, exactly. And then he sat down in front of him, and they ate it together, like looking in each other's eyes. And he was looking at this happy face of this person who was sharing with him, feeling the discomfort of, you know, his own, like, stinginess. And he said it changed his life. And from that time on, he became a more generous person and a much happier person. So I think that really gives you the flavor of generosity, literally the flavor of generosity. So this is what Ajahn Lee says, a Thai forest master. "People who develop the habit of being generous reap many rewards. Their act of generosity comes back to them, both in the present and on into the future. They have lots of friends. Other people trust them. Their hearts are light. They aren't weighed down with worries about looking after things they've given away. And these same results will keep coming in the future, just as when we have a bucket of rice grains. If we plant them in a field, we'll reap 10 buckets of rice grains in return. And the same holds true with the goodness we develop in this lifetime. It gives enormous returns. That's how people of discernment understand it." So he's pointing to a subtlety of discernment that comes with mindfulness. We really pay attention to what makes us happy. And that image of the rice bucket, you know, that you take some grains and then it multiplies, is actually a teaching I heard from Utejaniya, Sayadaw Utejaniya, who said that every mind moment creates a legacy. That whatever is in the mind conditions the mind. It's like we're planting seeds in our mind all the time. And those are legacy that we will be taking into the future. So there's a saying that you can't plant a mango seed and get an orange tree, right? So one of the things that's a very sobering is when we look at our mind and see what legacy are we planting? What future conditions are we bringing into our lives by the state of mind that we are cultivating, the states of mind that we're cultivating? I heard this teaching from Uteshaniya, and then I happened to be at my cousin's house, and she's a chef, and she was teaching at a cooking school, and she told me that one of the people that she worked with, her husband died suddenly, and she had three children. And she told Linda that week when she came to work that, you know, she went to the refrigerator and there was no food, and she had to get the kids ready for school, so she threw them in the back of her car, and they went through the McDonald's drive-in. So as she, you know, went through with her kids, she came to the drive-in window, and, you know, it was, she was very frazzled and very rushed. When she got to the window, the man behind the counter said, "The person in front of you paid for your meal." And she was just so, like, touched. You know, she said she started crying in the car. And then she paid for the meal of the person behind her. So this is a kind of example of how that legacy, what we do, actually creates the future. And when we look at it this way, renunciation takes on a different meaning. Renunciation becomes a happiness practice. We're not renouncing happiness, and we're not renouncing pleasure. We're renouncing the addictive qualities in our mind of greed, hatred, and delusion. There's a story, maybe you've heard it, about how in tribal cultures, the way they would find out where there was water was that they would put a banana in a gourd with a small hole, and then they would put it out there, and a monkey would come and stick their hand in the gourd and grab the banana, but they couldn't pull it out. And the monkey would stay there trying to get this banana, you know, for hours and hours and hours. Maybe, I don't know if it was days, but long enough to get really thirsty. And then they would break the gourd and the monkey would run to water and they could find where the water is. But we're, you know, I don't know how many, like, in terms of genetics, how far we are from monkeys, but we do have that tendency in our mind. We get fixated and we can't let go. We don't realize that letting go gives us freedom. You know, the freedom comes from letting go. There's a couple of retreat stories I thought I would share with you about the end of retreats that have to do with letting go. The first one was I heard on at Spirit Rock, and it was at the end of a 2-month retreat, and this woman raised her hand. You know, there was like a share at the end of the 2-month retreat, and she said, "I came to California from Minnesota for the sun, and it rained almost every day I was here. For 2 months, I almost never had dessert. I was a few miles from the ocean, and I never saw the sea. I cleaned bathrooms every day and rarely spoke to another person. And yet, I was happier than I'd ever been in my life." So I think this gives that flavor of, you know, happiness is not necessarily where we think it is. And then another time at the end of the 3-month retreat here, someone raised their hand and she said, "I had the most amazing retreat. So many incredible things happened, and I can't remember any of them." And the teacher said, you know, this isn't the Dharma store. It's more like the Dharma dump. The success of your retreat or the benefit of your retreat isn't what you get. It's what you leave behind. So I really like that teaching. Actually, at the time, I had no idea what they were talking about. I like it now. So, so what is it that we let go of? Is yes, it's this greed, hatred, and delusion, this grip, this fixation, this endless struggle in our mind. And there's a beautiful teaching from the Buddha. It's called the Cloth Sutta, about the benefits, what happens actually when we let go of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I like this story because of the textile imagery. I used to be a weaver, and in the story, the Buddha describes this beautiful silk cloth from Varanasi, and how if the cloth is dirty and you put it in the dye, no matter how beautiful and radiant the color of the dye, the fabric is not going to come out beautifully dyed because there's stains on the fabric. And then, you know, he's describing this story actually to a man who came to him and said that he was doing this ritual bathing in the Ganges River as a way to purify his karma. And the Buddha said, you can bathe in that river, you know, forever, but unless you clean your mind, unless you purify your mind, like washing this cloth, it won't take the beautiful qualities of heart. It won't take them completely. And you'll always have this legacy in the mind that's going to lead to future suffering. So this is what it says in the text. When he or she has given up, renounced, let go, abandoned, and relinquished the defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion, she knows, I am endowed with unwavering confidence in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha. So when we actually let go and see the joy that comes, we begin to be really confident in these teachings. And she gains enthusiasm for the goal, gains enthusiasm for the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When she is gladdened, joy is born in her. Being joyous in mind, her body becomes tranquil. Her body being tranquil, she feels happiness, and the mind of her who is happy becomes concentrated. Then she abides, having suffused with the mind of loving kindness one direction of the world, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, and so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to herself, she abides, sufficing the entire universe with loving kindness, with a mind grown great, lofty, boundless, and free from enmity and ill will. And then it goes on to say, and compassion, and appreciative joy, and equanimity, unbounded in every direction, when we let go of greed, hatred, and delusion. This can be a very profound and motivating inquiry for practice. What is there when greed, hatred, and delusion are gone? And this is something you can practice with at home in your everyday life, to really watch your mind in conversations, you know, in meetings, at the grocery store. You know, what's there when the mind lets go of its habitual tendencies to grasp? Mindfulness is another source of is another source of joy and happiness in and of itself. Truly connecting with each moment creates happiness. And there's actually research that shows this. Thousands of people on cell phones and checked in, and they were happier when they were really involved in what they were doing. And it didn't matter what the event was. It could be washing the dishes. But if they were paying attention to what they were doing, they were happier. There's a story that probably many of you know. It's a mindfulness teaching from the Buddha. It's called the Bahiya Sutta, it's a long story, and I don't want to go into all the details, but a man who had been shipwrecked and washed up to shore was assumed to be a great teacher by the community where he landed, and he sat under a tree and answered questions and kind of took on the role. And then he had this insight, like, well, maybe it's not true, you know. I think he had a dream, and David came down and said, there is someone, though, who is enlightened, and you can go and learn from him. So he went, he found the Buddha, and he asked the Buddha to teach him, and the Buddha was having arms, and he wasn't available. Then he asked a second time, and then a third time. And in these stories, typically if you ask three times, you get the answer. So this is what the Buddha said. Here in Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. And then he says, when for you in the seen is merely the seen, in the cognized is merely the cognized, etc. When, Bahia, you are not with that, you are not in that, you will not be in that. When, Bahia, you are not in that, then, Bahia, you will be neither here nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. This letting go of self, of this preoccupation with self. And then, of course, he was awakened. But I really, when I first heard this story, I thought, it seemed a little... I don't know what the word came to mind, maybe cold to me. Like I couldn't really get, like, I didn't understand it. And then there was a woman at Insight LA, a really remarkable person who was dying, actually. And she was young, you know, she had a son who was like, in his teens, and it was very sad. And she said, she shared that, you know, she didn't really understand that teaching either until now, when she had no future, she had no work to do, she just had this moment. And she said that it was like from this teaching, she just went from moment to moment, from person to person, from love to love, and that she felt so much love coming back to her. And I think we can forget how much that interest that we talk about as a kind of a step towards the factors of awakening in the mind, interest and love are very connected. So I wanted to just read to you something. It's a story that I read by Eve Ensler, the poet and writer. I'm not the poet, the playwright. And it's a story that I think really shows the movement of the mind from resistance and aversion to mindfulness and a kind of awakening. So this is what she wrote. I never want to see another tree. I said with bravado at 22 as I was speeding down a turnpike away from the green hills of Vermont toward Manhattan. A lot of aversion there. I think I said effing tree. I never want to see another effing tree. They had come to mean small towns, small minds, isolation, gossip, long freezing winters, endless green swallowing landscapes, skiing co-eds, empty chatter, families, babies, marriage, life. I drove out of the forest and hills and blue skies and nights of falling stars into concrete. After hour joints, mafia hitmen, anonymous sex, anonymous despair, gin and bourbon, and an end to morning, like the sun coming up, let alone trees. I see now how much I wanted to die, or how much I did not want to live with the pain inside me. So from her aversion, her rice seeds really sprouted into a lot of pain and suffering. And then what happened is she got cancer, and she was in a hospital bed, and she was stuck there for a long time. This is what she writes. What I hadn't anticipated was the tree. I was too weak to think or write or call or even watch a movie. All I could do was stare at the tree, which was the only thing in my view. At first, it annoyed me, and I thought I would go mad from boredom. But after the first days and many hours, I began to see the tree. On Tuesday, I meditated on bark. On Friday, the green leaves shimmering in the late afternoon light. For hours, I lost myself, my body, my being, dissolving into tree. I was raised in America. All values lie in the future, in the dream, in production. There's no present tense. There's no value in what is, only in what might be made or exploited from what already exists. I had no inherent value. Without work or effort, without making myself into something significant, without proving my worth, I had no right or reason to be here. So actually, to lie in my hospital bed and see tree, enter tree, to find the green life inherent in tree, this was the awakening. Every day, every hour, it was as if the tree began to reveal itself to me, or I began to see the tree, or both those things happened together. And I fell in love with that tree. I loved the bark, I loved the trunk, I loved the branches. It was just unbelievable. And by the end of my stay in the hospital, which was a few weeks, the tree actually blossomed, these white blossoms, and I felt like I was born back into nature somehow, like I had been asleep and I had awakened. So, you know, what a beautiful description of the happiness of mindfulness, of letting go of resistance. Another kind of aspect of happiness that comes to us in practice through concentration is the letting go of the hindrances. You know, when I first spoke about the hindrances and I went through that list from the Buddha, you know, how sense desire is like the beautiful dye in the water, and aversion, the boiling water, and then there's algae in the water for sloth and torpor, and the wind on the water for anxiety, and mud in the water for doubt. There's another list, actually, of the hindrances. So that's the list of when they're there. And the Buddha said we want to be mindful of the hindrances when they're there, and we want to be mindful when they're not there. This is a really important teaching because we often miss when they're not there. And when we practice mindfulness, we're collecting data to actually find out about happiness. And there's incredible happiness when they're gone. It's just that we're on to the next craving and we miss it. You know, have you ever had like a toothache or like, you know, I don't know, You know, when you have the flu and you just think, oh my God, if I only feel better, I'll just be happy, you know? And there is that happiness the day you wake up and it's gone. But we miss the significance of that. So this other list is that when we let go of greed, it's like getting out of debt. So, you know, if we need something to make ourselves feel better, that's greed. We don't really appreciate that we're fine. So it's like getting out of debt. When we let go of ill will, it's like getting rid of a sickness. Like ill will is like being sick, and then we are not sick anymore. And sloth and torpor is like being imprisoned. And we get out. And anxiety, it's like being a slave, you know, like the obsessive over and over and over. And then we're free. And doubt, when we get rid of doubt, it's like we've been given a map through the desert and we get to our destination after being lost. So to be mindful when you have those moments of peace, of release, and then notice the hindrances aren't there. This is the happiness that comes from a concentrated mind. There's a poem I like a lot. It's by Haikuin, Japanese poem. It's, "The monkey is reaching for the moon in the water. Until death overtakes him, he'll never give up. If he let go of the branch and disappear in the deep pool, the whole world would shine with dazzling pureness." I've always loved this poem, but it kind of solved a problem for me. Because when I was in my teacher training at Spirit Rock, something really amazing happened. It was after a really long day in a very hot, crowded house, and a friend of mine and I went to take a walk. And we were walking down a fire road, and if you've ever been in that area, there's grass, tall grass, and I could see in the grass these little triangles like were ears, but I couldn't tell if it was a fox or a coyote because I couldn't really tell the height. But closer than the back of the room, there was a clearing, and this coyote came out and sat down. And it was the end of the day, you know, and the sun was going down, and we just kind of sat there and watched this coyote, and it started to stretch its neck. And I'm like, oh my God. And it's just reaching up and stretching its neck. And then, you know, we could hear these little gurgling sounds. And then the sun went down and the moon came up, and the coyote started howling at the moon. And not only that, but it must have been the first coyote because it howled at the moon, and then in every direction, in total circle, all the other coyotes started howling. So it was quite extraordinary. I thought, oh, I wish I could make a Dharma talk out of it. But I couldn't think of anything until I read this poem, and I remembered, oh yeah, the moon is a symbol for enlightenment. All beings want to be happy, even coyotes. So, of course, one of the things that really brings great happiness to our life is the practice of metta. And Oprah was interviewing the Dalai Lama, and at the end of the interview, she said, "Every month I do a column in the magazine called What I Know For Sure. What do you know for sure?" And this is what he said, "Altruism is the best source of happiness. There is no doubt about that." Another story, actually, about the Dalai Lama is he was traveling, he was at Spirit Rock, and he travels with Secret Service, you know, because of the political tension in Tibet. And so at the end of the retreat, he was holding the hands of the people in the Secret Service, and they were taking pictures on their iPhone, and someone asked one of the Secret Service people, you know, what makes him special? Why is he different than other people that you've traveled with? And they said, what makes him special is he makes us feel special. And this is that practice of altruism, of, you know, offering kindness and generosity and attention to others. Thich Nhat Hanh says that when our hearts are small, our understanding and compassion are limited. They're limited and we suffer. We can't accept or tolerate others and their shortcomings, and we demand that they change. But when our hearts expand, these same things don't make us suffer anymore. We have a lot of understanding and compassion and can embrace others. We accept others as they are, and then they have a chance to transform. When we feed and support our own happiness, we are nourishing our ability to love. That's why to love means to learn the art of nourishing our happiness. Understanding someone's suffering is the best gift you can give another person. Understanding is love's other name. If you don't understand, you can't love. One of the problems I think we have with happiness on the path is that in some ways it's really been corrupted by our culture. You know, you can drive down Sunset Boulevard where they have these huge billboards, and you might think that being happy was having perfect teeth and sitting in a bar next to two other people with perfect teeth, you know. It's a kind of strange, like, promotion of, like, what happiness is. And actually, it, you know, if you've ever been in a situation like that, it's not very happy. It's actually quite uncomfortable. This is what Trungpa Rinpoche says. For the brave, it's joyful to be in good health, joyful to keep good posture, joyful to experience that you are alive, that you are here. You can appreciate the colors of the world, and you can appreciate the temperature of the air. You can appreciate smells, and you can appreciate sounds. There is a tremendous feeling of pleasure and appreciation. But at the same time, there is sadness. It's like the sound of a flute, which is so melodic and so beautiful that it ravishes your mind. It's almost like a mixed blessing, sweet and sour together. So joy brings a sense of sadness at the same time. Joy doesn't stay by itself. If it does, there must be something wrong with it, something perverted about it. So that's really important to understand, that a heart filled with metta, loving kindness, compassion, equanimity is responsive. It responds to what's, to the joys with happiness, to the sorrows with compassion. And they're not separate. It's the full range of the heart and being alive. Motivating ourselves from love and interest or care rather than self-criticism brings joy to our practice. Connecting with the part of yourself that truly wants to live a meaningful, happy life, really values peace of mind, peace in the world. This is our bodhicitta, the natural kind of heart, the genuineness of the heart that really is drawn to practice. You know, it takes time, actually, and mindfulness to learn to trust that, that the Dharma has momentum, that we're already in the Dharma, and we love the Dharma. It's the language of the heart. It's a natural fit. So this is what a letter I really love that Albert Einstein wrote to his son. And it's about the joy of being truly interested in loving what you do. These days I have completed one of the most beautiful works of my life. When you are bigger, I will tell you about it. I'm very pleased that you find joy with the piano. This and carpentry are, in my opinion, for your age, the best pursuits, better even than school, because these are things that fit a young person such as you very well. Mainly play the things on the piano which please you, even if the teacher does not assign those. That is the way to learn the most. When you are doing something with such enjoyment that you don't notice that the time passes, I am sometimes so wrapped up in my work that I forget about the noon meal. So just like the piano is a perfect fit for someone like his son, the Dharma is a perfect fit for us. And we just have to actually follow what we love. I once heard, in terms of that, being motivated by a kind of should, I once heard Kamala Masters say that when she was sitting at the forest refuge with Utejaniya, she said to him, "I'm feeling like I should sit in the hall more, that I should sit in the hall rather than in my room." And he said, "Don't practice because of should. That's just greed in the mind. You know, let the authentic, follow what your authentic wish." And, and there's a great teaching in that, I think. So the last thing I wanted to mention, to be sure to mention, that brings happiness in our practice is the practice of sila, of ethical behavior. The happiness trainings, the precept commitments to do no harm that we took at the beginning of the retreat. This practice is really a happiness practice. And there's a conversation between Ananda, who I mentioned the other night, and the Buddha about the practice of sila, of virtue. So Ananda asked the Buddha, "What, O Venerable One, is the reward and blessing of wholesome morality?" And the Buddha says, "Freedom from remorse, Ananda." "And of freedom from remorse, joy, Ananda." "And of joy, rapture, Ananda." "And of rapture, tranquility, Ananda." "And of tranquility, happiness, Ananda." "And of happiness, concentration, Ananda." "And of concentration, vision and knowledge according to reality." "And of vision and knowledge according to reality, disenchantment. Another word for disenchantment is the letting go of delusion, seeing things the way they really are, not being enchanted with our crazy habits of mind about what we think will make us happy. "And of turning away and disenchantment, the vision and knowledge with regards to liberation." So happiness is a precondition for seeing reality, actually. It gives us the nourishment and stability to really have the energy and the commitment and the motivation to practice deeply and see clearly. So I think what I'd like to do now is just sit for a moment and end with the words of the Buddha. "Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves you. So may you really appreciate the goodness of your heart. May that appreciation give rise to happiness and joy. And may our practice and our good intentions be of benefit to all beings without exception. Thank you for your practice.